Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. You can listen and subscribe to the show for free on Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Blog Talk Radio, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Ben Lytle, and we'll be talking about his soon-to-be-released book, The Potentialist, Your Future in the New Reality of the Next 30 Years. The next 30 years will include a seismic shift in well-known institutions such as government, education, religion, news media, and reliance on employers. Ben Lytle looks at this new future through a lens of opportunity, not anxiety and fear, while emphasizing now is the time to take action for all of us, from single parents to major business CEOs in tech to fashion. Ben Lytle's book, The Potentialist, Your Future in the New Reality of the Next 30 Years, is a future shot for the 21st century, explaining how every one of us can thrive during these rapid changes by becoming a potentialist. Former chair and CEO of Anthem Healthcare, with current market value of more than $100 billion, Ben Lytle is a self-made serial entrepreneur CEO known for being ahead of the curve. Democratization is a part of that, and the only way to survive and react is to adapt. For more information, you can visit Ben's website, which is potentialistfuture.com. That's P-O-T-E-N-T-I-A-L-I-S-T, potentialistfuture.com. With that, I'd like to welcome Ben to the show. Good day, Ben.
Hello, good day. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure, and your book is one of those very thought-provoking style books that one has to take and digest in small parts, you know, and to get a bigger picture. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about the book. Now, the book is due to be released a week from today, correct? So people can go ahead and pre-order now.
Yes, that's right. It'll be released for purchase on September 27th, and you can pre-order now.
Great. So let's start with, you know, the title, the term, potentialist, really caught my attention when your publicist first contacted me. So would you mind explaining to the listeners a little bit about what a potentialist is, and how does it differ from a futurist?
Okay, yeah, thank you. Well, essentially, a potentialist is a person who just possesses a set of attitudes about life and about not only their own life but the human race, and it's sort of a collection of ideas, philosophies, but more important, how we act. And so, for example, at its core, a potentialist believes tries to do their personal best, to be their personal best, and leave the world and the people that they meet along the way a little bit better than they found them. They don't have to do magnificent things. They just do a little bit better than they found them. And we believe that the best days of the human race and our best days are in front of us, regardless of what your age is. And we're looking at the future. A futurist studies the future of humanity. Whereas potentials, you know, we're more focused on our individual potential, but they're one and the same. So I am both a futurist and a potentialist, and so I think of them as one and the same. One is simply studying individuals and trying to be our individual best, and the other is trying to do what we can to get the best out of the human race. So that's, hopefully that answers your question. And happy to follow up if you want.
Yeah, no, it does. It seems that the potentialist is kind of an active participant in that future, where to me, as I was reading it, to me it seemed like a futurist approached it from a more of an observer kind of role versus participant.
Exactly right. That's a great observation. You're exactly right. So since I was a very young man in my 20s, I started collecting stories, just notes and observations of incredible people that I met. Not just someone I thought would be incredible, but I think anybody would if you spent time with them and listened to them for a while. Some of them, of course, were historical figures, but it was more I was meeting people like that in all walks of life. I mean, one of the people that I think is one of the greatest potentialists I ever met is today she's an elderly lady, but she was an immigrant. Her biggest job was as a maid, a corporate maid. But she has a remarkable life story, and she has touched so many lives in a positive way, and she's given all she's got. And at this day, at well over 80 years old, every day she gets up and she gives her best to do her best, to be her best. So that's what we look for.
Yeah. I kind of had a little bit of, resonance when I was reading about your growing up and childhood and all the different jobs, and one of them you indicated was hailing hauling hay, and that was like hauling hay hell. I had to laugh because I spent in my family, my mother's second husband, they had a farm. And one summer they thought, it was really good. We're going to put Robert on the farm, and show him where work is all about. And I'll tell you, hauling hay, lifting that hay was, I mean, truly, that was when I really committed myself to college. I was definitely back for this year.
Fortunately, these days people don't do that kind of work anymore. But believe me, in Texas heat with about 9,500 degrees and 95% humidity, and lifting hay that then stuck to you and stung like crazy was really quite an experience.
Absolutely. So why now, Ben? Why write this story at this particular time? What is it about this period that you feel this needs to be out there for people to ponder?
Well, we're at a critical phase, I think, in the history of humanity. We are in a transition. The World Economic Forum calls it the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I actually think it's much, much more than that. But people are right now, I think pretty much everyone is distressed by the fact that we see so much division in the country and we feel a lot of people are fearful. A recent news poll said 70% of the people polled said that they thought the future was going to be worse than today. And a lot of young people, I've heard many, many young people say, I don't want to bring children in this world, this awful world. It's just not true. It is simply not true. We live in the best time in history. And the struggle with the division we're going through right now has occurred many, many times in history. And if you really study the arc of history, which I've done, we're a 3 million year old species, and it follows a very predictable pattern of struggles, division, and then we something better comes. And that's what's happening now. And I felt it really important to explain that, to look back and look at the arc of history, look at what's happened before, explain this is simply a transition and it's going to be better in the future. And the reason that it's so difficult today for people to see that is that we have so many sources in our society that make money by dividing us and by make money by negativity, because that appeals to sort of a primal fear we have. So, but it's simply not true. And so what I want to do is to help people see that there is a very, very positive future in the future ahead of us, but it could be rough getting there. And whether it's rough or it's not so rough and it's manageable depends on every single one of us. If the Calvary's not coming from somewhere else, it's not coming from government, it's not coming from somewhere else, it has to be us. We have to ourselves take a realistic, pragmatically optimistic view of the future, and we have to teach that to our children. We have to prepare them. When I say children, in my case, I'm talking about people 50 and under. We have to give them the life skills to succeed through these turbulent times and not lose their perspective about the opportunities ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there, you know, the depression and the angst, you know, that children, you know, the teenage suicide rate being so high. I mean, and these children, these kids, literally kids, you know, have their life in front of them, and you know, so many things can be accomplished, but it's cut short because what they see is it's just not hopeful. You know, I mean, and it's really sad. I think that you know, we as a society need to focus.
It really, yeah. Excuse me, King, for me, because again, it is simply not the truth. And I'll give you a simple test. How many people, you know, I take the city you're in, I'll take Phoenix, that's where, you know, where I'm located. How many people did you turn on the radio this morning or the TV and heard someone say, hello there, you know, 4.5 million people had a pretty darn great day yesterday in Phoenix. For 325, really bad. Nobody says that. And so we get this inverted of the world because that's what news has thought they always wanted. And nowadays the business model, not just for news, but for politicians and everything else, is if I can scare you, if I can make you angry, then my message will appeal to you. I can get you as to watch my TV show, or I can get you to vote for me. And unfortunately, that's a very destructive thing for our young people. And the only people that are going to protect them is us. We as parents and grandparents have to really be active here. And this is my message is all about action. In my book, I lay out, do these seven things. If you just do these seven things over the next few decades, you're going to be way ahead of the crowd. And then my other two books try to take it even further. But that's the basic message, and that's the answer to why now. And I'm devoting a lot of, you know, my time and that I could be spending, relaxing, and I, you know, and doing other things, spend my personal to carry this message.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you bringing it forward, and it really is, you know, you're casting a wide kind of swath, you know, to capture, you know, as many as possible. And you know, and I'm sure the grandkids would love to see more of the granddad around, you know, during this time. But you're doing it for them. You're doing it for your children, the grandkids, and not only yours, but everyone else as well. So,
yeah, really. I can't do this by myself. Obviously, I can only touch so many people. So I'm asking, you know, all of your listeners who are parents or grandparents and everyone they talk to, you know, start with your own family. start giving them a perspective of, wait a minute, if you think things are bad now, go back and take a hard look at the 20th century. Take a hard look at the 19th, the 18th. You'll see this is not anywhere near, we're being sold a bill of goods, and it's just simply because we're not paying attention to, not looking at it with perspective. And so we have to offer that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like the old, I walked to school in the snow 2 miles, you know, back in the day, you know, before buses or any of that thing happened. So, yeah, and it is important, you know, to get that perspective. Now, one of those things in your book, you kind of break down some of, in part one, the forces of change. And one of those forces of change, you talk about innovation and its counter resistance. I'd like to talk a little bit about that. So can you give us kind of just a high level? I mean, obviously in the book you go into detail, but kind of just a high level idea of that particular force and counterforce and how it plays out.
Sure. There are natural laws, and these natural laws are the laws that hold the universe in place, and we'd like to think, well, those are out there, but they actually affect each of our lives. We don't tend to think of them every day as natural law, but we understand the principle of every action creates an equal and opposite reaction. And that has a function in nature. You know, it holds galaxies together, and in the case of innovation, and I'm talking about all innovation or any advancement, if you will, there's a resistance to it. It always comes with problems, unforeseen problems. We all know that. Any of us that have ever worked anywhere and installed a new system, we know, boy, it's great. Oh my gosh, but it's got all these. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we didn't happen coming. You know, we get a wonderful thing like the smartphone, and then we realize, holy smokes, you know, it's kind of dominating our lives. You know, we become its slave. So we have to first of all just understand that that happens. A lot of people become cheerleaders for innovation, and I'm one of them. Innovation, particularly democratizing innovation, that makes something that was available only to a few available to many and ultimately everyone, is really what's lifted humanity. Again, if you go back and study the arc of history, that's really what's lifted humanity. So, and a good example is the printing press, and the invention of writing, steam power first, and then all the different changes, the way we had power so we weren't limited to what we could do on a horse. Those are the kinds of democratizing innovations. They're wonderful, but we all have to learn. That's part of the growing up as now innovate, particularly technology and automation plays an important part of our life, is always stop and think. What can go wrong, and am I prepared for that? And as systems designers, because I'm still heavily involved in technology, we're trying to be better at it too. We're trying to anticipate what could go wrong and counter it as much as possible. Now, why does that dynamic occur? It appears it's sort of like nature's quality control system. We innovate, and then it says, okay, you didn't quite get it right. So until you get it right, we're going to slow it down. And so we can see that today with, you know, we have this wonderful thing called the Internet. We love it. Suddenly, we've got predators inside of our house through the Internet. Many predators. We see it. Well, we didn't think that through. So now we're inventing something, you know, like blockchain and other security systems that can protect us better. But that's sort of the function that plays and it also plays that in our own life. You know, we all face adversity, and we want to blame. We think things ought to be smooth. Never going to happen.
Yeah. The one thing that I gained most from that particular discussion that you had in that book was the idea of resistance, not seeing resistance as a malicious force, but actually beneficial, you know. And there are so many times, I had some of my previous incarnation as a worked in IT with banking. And you know, and one of the things that we would see was that the resistance that would be in place to anything that we would, you know, create. And it seemed that it was anti-innovation. I mean, that it was stymieing advancement, you know, rather than look at it as being that quality control, which is a much more healthy perspective.
Right. Yeah, it's very important to understand that in our own lives, because adversity is your friend. It really is. It's where you learn. It's where your greatest opportunity is not to learn, not to repeat mistakes. It's to learn when you're out over the ends of your skis, which, you know, we all occasionally do. So it's a very practical application, and that's the kind of thing that I have one whole chapter in the second book devoted to understanding natural law and how to work with it in your life instead of thinking that you're being punished or thinking that it's just, you know, bad luck or whatever. It's really most of the time us not acting in conformity to the natural law around us. So it's a good lesson, and we can see it every day if we really pay attention.
Yeah, it is. And again, you know, it just, if you can change your perspective on it, it just shifts everything. I mean, it shifts your actions, your future actions, your behaviors.
Right.
But it's important to recognize you have different perspectives is available.
That's exactly right. And that you mentioned that, Robert, a lot of times when I, you know, the book cover of this book is very unusual because it shows an elevation, sort of an evolution of mankind going up to wisdom at the peak. And I get often asked, how do you define wisdom? And you'd be surprised by the people who actually ask me that question. And it would be that they didn't know. But there's a classical definition, and it's really quite simple and quite good. It's the art of living well. And the art of living well comes two components. Having perspective, because when we lose perspective, we simply do not understand the life around us and the life we're living. And secondly, applying that perspective to everyday life and decisions. That's wisdom. That's simply all it is. And it can be taught. We can learn. We can accelerate maturity and wisdom. But we tend to think, oh, well, that's only comes with age and experience. No, it certainly helps. But you can accelerate it. The Greeks did it 2,500 years ago. And we're really quite good at it. We can learn a lot from how they did it. Classical education still uses those Greek techniques and produces some pretty good outcomes in education. So that's a big part of what I'm trying to do here. Living to your potential is, in fact, achieving wisdom, which is arguably the highest human achievement.
Yeah, and on that cover, I mean, the steps, you begin with data, then it goes information, knowledge, and then wisdom. And I happen to notice that it's like, not till you get to wisdom do you see a heart, excuse me, at the center of the figure with a kind of a halo around it. So it's like up to that point, it seems to be I don't want to say cold, but I mean, it doesn't, like, without feeling. I mean, it is more,
we don't achieve one of the greatest attributes of wise people, and you're welcome to study them on your own, see, but the one of the greatest attributes of wise people is empathy, true empathy for their fellow man and for other people. They can be very strong. They can be very decisive people, be tough when they need to be, but they never lose their empathy for others. And in fact, it dominates their personalities.
Yeah. That's, and it's good to know that, again, one does not have to be aged in order to demonstrate. And you know, I have seen some of the wisest kids, you know, lately. It seems that that empathy and that compassion is, it just sometimes just pops out, you know, at when I'm looking at, you know, some of these children. And, you know, I find it hopeful. You know, when you were talking about hope versus despair, to me, you know, whenever I see those kinds of compassionate actions by the real younger generation, that gives me hope. And then, you know, then we can kind of, from that point on, you know, work towards achieving more of that in the world.
I couldn't agree more. I surround myself with a lot of young people and people of all ages. I have enormous belief in these young people. But again, going back to, we need to act. We parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, our job is to help these young people become the greatest generation, even surpassing those that saved us, in World War II. We have to prepare these young people, because they're going to need everything they've got to get us through this period as painlessly as possible. But I believe in them. They're incredible. They have incredible potential, and it's our job to help bring it out. And that's part of the reason for the title.
Yeah, I agree. Let's see, we're about halfway through the show already, Ben. So I'm going to take just a quick 90-second break. And then when we come back, you mentioned the democratization and the effect that it has on our activities. So I want to talk about a little bit about that and versus or in comparison to the institutionalization, which is also talked about in your book, okay?
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. I'll be back.
Great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us, and I hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,600 shows that we have had during the past 12 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide, books, nature photography, calendars, and 5x7 photo greeting cards. Our show is a free podcast on Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone. Thank you for staying with us again today. My special guest is Ben Lytle, and we're talking about his soon-to-be-released book, The Potentialist, Your Future in the New Reality of the Next 30 Years. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is potentialistfuture.com. And again, his book will be released next week, a week from today, on September 27th. But you can go ahead and pre-order now, and it is a very interesting read. So, okay, with that, we're back then.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so you mentioned in the first half of the show, you know, democratization and the act of making something available to everyone. And there was one quote that I wanted to read that was kind of something to think about, and it was from you, that democratization is the action of making something and in total everything, available or accessible to everyone. Keep in mind the definition is not the action of making something available or accessible to nice people, but to everyone. So is that warning you have to kind of be careful of what you wish for?
That's persistence at work again. So you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Ron. Go ahead.
I was going to say, democratization. So talk about that. And then you also, again, mentioned deinstitutionalization. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so if you – and these, by the way, are not my originals. This is based on the work of Alvin Toffler from his first book in 1970, Future Shock, and two other books, 10 years follow the third wave. And so these three books in total. But then since that time, many other people have referenced it. The futurist Peter Diamandis references this work a lot as well. I think of it as a force of nature or a force of evolution. Now you could argue, well, there were just innovative people and they came up with ideas. But it could be that. Rather than getting into me what's kind of a pointless argument, I just say, well, it is. Whether it was the innovators came first or the democratizing ideas came first, it's up to you. You can decide for yourself. Fact is, it has existed. You can quickly wrap your head around it if you think, as I referenced a little earlier in your show, of some of the innovations from the past that did exactly that. They made what was available to a few, available to many, and then ultimately almost everyone. So the invention of writing. The printing press is a great example for a couple of reasons. Books, up until the invention of the printing press with movable type, was only available to the wealthy and the clergy. That was it. But once that was invented, and I'm working off my memory here, isn't always great, but if I remember correctly, in only like 60 years or so, there was something like 40 million books. I mean, it just exploded. That was the level of demand to have books. But that also triggered other democratizing innovations. So the availability of books created a demand for literacy. A demand for literacy created the demand for universal education. So that's how this works. And so you go forward more to more recent times, the Internet. And that made so much information available to everybody that never before. I mean, you have had to go down to the library and spend hours to do what one good search will do now. So incredibly powerful. And then, of course, the smartphone, the most recent, incredibly democratizing innovation. Now, talking about not being for or how it's not available just for nice people. When we democratized through the access to information and knowledge through the Internet, it also created a two-way street for people who could now connect through emails and, of course, now text to who are basically predators, trying to figure out some way to scam somebody out of something. Before, if you kind of stayed away from certain, bad areas, you didn't run into those people. Now they're in your home. And so they got democracy. Their access got spread as well. So that's an example of not everyone. Another one, of course, is of the democratization of war. People can now, almost anybody can make war on anybody else. And that goes way beyond the way we used to think about it. So these things get democratized. They always come with that good, but they always bring something we have to deal with.
But dealing with it then ultimately advances us again. So I think that explains democratization. And another word that might be helpful for people, because it's kind of popular right now, is bespoke, meaning curated exactly for me. So that's the force that's at work. We can see it in retail. We can see today. We can see it how you know our preferences are known, and so it's easier for us to find what we bought before and all that kind of stuff online. We can see it in entertainment, how we've moved to streaming, how we once had the studios and the agents and the movie houses, the distributors. They controlled what we could see. Now we have more choices than we can imagine. And so that's another example of democratization. Deinstitutionalization is based on this very important principle that Toffler wrote about, and it has to do with the pace of change. So when more and more things become innovation is democratized, we're faced with more and more choices. I mean, it's wonderful. We got choices. Man, it's great. But it demands a lot more of our time, right? But individuals can change very fast. So we can overnight say, okay, cable's out, you know, streaming's in, a taxi's out, oops, in. But organization, whether it's a business or if it's a big business like a corporation, or a really, really huge organization that become our societal institutions, like government, healthcare, mass media, education, they have multiple constituencies they have to satisfy. And also, a lot of times, their business models are dependent on the status quo. So they're more resistant, and even if they want to get on board, it's hard for them to react as fast. What happens as the pace of change accelerates, and keep in mind it's accelerating because more and more innovations are democratizing, then what happens is these institutions can't keep up. And they more and more start to serve their internal constituency rather than their customers. And so what happens then is that gap starts to grow, and they also get shaky. They begin to have a lot of problems. Real easy test, if you want to see this, ask yourself, going back to any of those institutions I just named, and I would add, include in that organized religion and others, are any of them more stable, growing, and better respected today than they were 10 years ago? And I think you're going to say no. Well, why? Did they suddenly all get useless? No, they're not keeping up with the pace at which the world's changing. That's the institutionalization. Doesn't mean some cases they'll go away. Some of the big companies we've seen that just disappeared because they didn't Blockbuster. Blockbuster had a chance to buy Netflix for $50 million, and they didn't. And now Netflix is around, they're gone. And that's pure deinstitutionalization. You're gone. You're disrupted. And then you have a chance whether you adapt or not. Some companies adapt. Some organizations and institutions adapt. Others don't. So the way I like to think it as far as our big institutions that I mentioned, government and education and so forth, there is a 2.0. that they have to become. And that 2.0 is the next version of themselves. And how rough our next 20 or 30 years is going to largely depend on how well they get the message and really start embracing the new way for that institution to function.
Yeah. So with the recognizing that maybe an institution is out of sync with, you know, the rest of the zeitgeist, what's going on, the democratization. is the answer to, I mean, is, but I obviously have to adapt. So is the answer to creating, is the answer creating better systems, internal systems, internal processes, to deal with rapid change?
Yeah, now the answer, Robert, it's actually in the book, and it spells out the six characteristics of a democratized, of democratization. What happens? And it really starts with, though, every CEO, every leader, President of the United States, the leaders of Congress, the heads of news media organizations, every one of them should be asking themselves, what would my industry or my institution look like totally democratized? How would we build that? Mm-hmm. And then look at the six characteristics, and it has some very specific things. Eliminating middlemen, where people, the customer or the voter or whoever it is, has more direct influence in how things are. Adapting it, personalizing it for your customer. So the clearest example, I can give you a couple of examples I think people can relate to more easily, is think about retail. What is the ultimate democratization of retail? 3D printing. I design it. Mm. I build it. I order the materials to put in my 3D printer, and I print it. Or I go down to the local, little store, a little UPS store, or someplace that has that service and has the fancier 3D printers, and I print myself a custom pair of shoes. That's the ultimate retail. If you think about what Tesla's doing, Tesla is customizing that individual vehicle to be yours. Again, bespoke. And you're buying from Tesla, you're dealing with only Tesla, you're not dealing with middlemen. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. And so for education, the goal is bespoke learning. I can learn anything, anywhere, at any time in the world, any place in the world, for a fraction of what it costs today, and I can do it because it knows exactly how I learn. That's bespoke.
Wow. A little something. Very interesting.
but it's happening. The thing is, if you understand it, watch it. I mean, if you watch what, not that they're a perfect organization, but they're learning, is watch the ride services, Uber, Lyft, these kind of people. They now know you. They know the driver. They're putting you together, and they're learning what you like, and they're learning what the driver likes. They're rating both of you, so that the union is hopefully something that works well. That's the world we're headed into. And it's good if we do it right. As we know, there'll be problems. You're going to have to work through problems. But that's a powerful concept when you think about it.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. Like I said, your book is very thought-provoking. Now, on the... on your website, you have a little tab that talks about the principles, 10 principles of a potentialist. And I like to talk about a couple of them, because they tap into some of the up-and-coming things to be on the lookout for. Like, for example, one of them, the principles, was talking about your legacy as a superhuman. And the idea of us being able to be in concert with machinery or be cyborgs of a certain type or a certain degree. So can you tell us about the idea of going beyond human expectations or limitations?
Yeah, and I'll make a prediction, which wasn't as clearly stated in the book, but I'll predict it right now, and that's that in the next 2 to 3 decades, almost everything we think about today as a limit of human potential will be upended. It simply will not be the same. On this particular, I've tried to, this is something that we naturally are scared of, because when you say androids, you say cyborg, words like that, you know, we get these scary images of half, you know, of half human, and more automation than human. It will occur more incrementally than that. Mm-hmm. It already has occurred more incrementally, but it's more making us aware now. Start thinking, you know, being wise enough, how will we use this power that comes our way? A couple of examples. The internet made us, integrated us more tightly with automation than ever in history. Incredible democratizing innovation. Almost everybody in the world now has access to it, and everybody in the world will have access within another 5-10 years. Even more so, the smartphone. And so when we think forward about being further integrated with automation, we need to look back and say, okay, who was I before I had a smartphone? Would I want to go back there? Probably nobody would. On the other hand, have I managed it all that well? Well, probably not so. You know, I'm still learning how to manage it so that it doesn't enslave me. I keep it in its proper role. But we don't think of it mostly as our enemy, or we don't think of it, you know, as taking us over, but it can. So that's what we're talking about here. There's one or two innovations that are on their way, and it will radically accelerate our power as human beings, if you will, our capability. It'll enhance our potential, just as the smartphone did. Which, by the way, if we went back 100 years, we would have, and we carried a smartphone with us that worked, people would think of us as superhuman. If you went back 200 or 300 years, probably you'd burn at stake. So with the power. So you know, this it's all relative, right? But the big change, and again, I'm an old IT guy. I've been involved in information technology since I was, you know, 17 years old. So I go way back to the early days, and I've watched all this occur. One thing that hasn't changed, and it's kind of astonishing if you think about it, we still need, for us, on the one hand, we've got this incredibly powerful computer called our brain that boggles the minds of anybody, of its scientists even today, the power it has. On the other side, we're building incredibly more powerful computers all the time and computing capacity. And a good way to sort of represent it to ourselves is the cloud. All the things that are out there in the cloud and the internet. Incredible. And it's going to get more and more and more. The connection between those two today, after more than 70 years of progress with computers, is still a keyboard and a screen. So I'm limited. My brain's limited by how fast I can type and how fast I can. And that's going to go away. It's going to either give way, you know, what's sometimes called natural language, you know, which means all I got to do is speak into it. So it's like Super Siri, you know. Or at some point it will be likely, we'll simply, instead of holding the keyboard in our hand, holding the smartphone in our hands and typing into it, we'll just wear it on our ear as an earpiece of some kind, or maybe as a pair of glasses, but more likely maybe a simple earpiece or something like that. Who knows? And we'll speak to it about what we want, and we'll get it. Or we'll at some point perhaps even just think it, and it will happen. Yeah. Directed thought. So when that changes, start thinking about that as you. Now, that seems, depending upon your age, you might say, well, that's never going to happen for me. I don't even want that. But you look at your 6-year-old grandchild or your 18-year-old. They're going to live it. And you watch right now what they do. Watch them how fast they are with their phones. How natural it comes to them. Watch how they watch little short snackables and listen to snackables of things, you know, 10, 15 minute, 3 minute, 2 minute. Their brains are being prepared for that innovation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very much so. And I agree with you that, that preparation. And I've seen it just when I'm out and about and I, see, 2, 3, 4-year-old, in front of a screen, and very easily and effortlessly, navigating, through whatever it is that they're watching. It is amazing.
All us look really clumsy, right? we all feel stupid. You get a 4-year-old that can navigate a system better than you can. It's amazing.
Yeah, but we had screens put in front of us, they had the capability. We might have done that. But it is a sound of the times in a way. It's the nature of the current world.
Right. And it's one of the things for all of us that are older than, let's say, older than 30 today, but particularly quite a bit older. Is don't look and immediately judge it's wrong. Instead, look and say, what could be going on here? What could be happening? Because it's usually it's one of the ways, if you're a futurist, you look for what's coming. You don't immediately assume that it's bad. You simply observe and say, what could that mean? I'll tell you a quick little story for me personally. Years before I ever heard of self-driving cars, years, I began to observe that a lot of teenagers weren't interested in driving. A lot of them even didn't get their license. And as a guy who grew up in a car culture, and I love my cars, still do, I couldn't understand it. I thought, wow, that's interesting. And then, of course, self-driving cars start to become something that's coming. And Uber came out. And it's not the same for those kids. But it wasn't a bad thing, I can't really say there was a lot of social virtue in loving cars as much as we did. So these kids were headed to a better place, right? And not driving while they're drinking. Those things, So anyway, that's a good example.
Yeah, exactly. So, gosh, we're down to the last almost 5 or 6 minutes here. So a couple things. You talk about a new reality, and I noticed throughout the book there are a couple of times that COVID-19 came into the discussion or into the reading, and it seems that the pandemic created a lot of kind of like a starting point of a major shift. Of things happening. So, for example, one of the things you talk about in the future, the potential is that, the work from home or work from anywhere kind of mentality, got a lot of boost during this particular period. So in your opinion, how did our walk through this, pandemic, how did that contribute to what you see as maybe some of that new reality up and coming?
But thanks for asking that question. Yeah, if you study the arc of history, and there's so much to learn there, one of the things that you learn is out of the most horrible times come good things. It's just nature's way. It's never all bad and it's never all good. And so, for example, out of the Black Plague came a huge labor shortage, which forced people, the employers of that day, to start raising wages, and that led to a better quality of life, and it also led to what ultimately became the Renaissance, because people
viewed life and death very differently. So you can never predict, you know, there's always going to be good coming out of bad times, which is, of course, what I'm saying now. So coming back to the pandemic, I started writing this book, and a couple of things happened from the time I started writing. First of all, I started out looking at a 50-year time horizon, and it came down to 30 years, and I'm not sure I wouldn't revise it to 20 today if I were redoing it. So things are happening faster, not slower, which is a reversal of where we've usually had with futurists. Usually futurists were right, but they were way, way, way out in front. The second mm-hmm. thing was that many of the things I was writing about got dramatically accelerated. And my book was already, you know, in process of being finalized. But many of those things got accelerated. So work from anywhere, which is another way, say it another way, democratization of the workforce. Bespoke, mm-hmm. I mean, workplace, excuse me. It's mm-hmm. a bespoke work. I work from where I want to work. Totally changes how we look at retirement, how we look at lifestyles. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of the people that's saying, well, we have to be together, it's not an all or nothing thing. Some tasks you do, some tasks you don't. Some jobs you do, some jobs you don't. In a bespoke environment, you figure out what you need and what you don't. And for those people that it works better, there's a lot of great benefits from work from anywhere. It's better for the environment. We don't have commuting. It's better for mental health. We don't have commuting. It's better for the pocketbook. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have the clothes and the gas and the, you know, so there's a lot of good things from it, but the, you know, it's right. There's times when people have to learn to get work together, but also the tools of how we work together is accelerating so fast, that, you know, in a few years we'll be able to have virtual meetings, and it'll feel like we're sitting there together. It'll never be the same. It'll never be, or not never, I don't like to say that. It's hard to imagine that we would ever totally get to a point where we could be happy with it being an electronic connection, but we can say a lot of the things we can do that we haven't even explored yet. So I think the also medicine, I think we saw a miracle in how fast we were able to produce those vaccines and the therapies that mm-hmm. took the death rate, and that has since launched a whole new area of medicine, programmable medicine that's phenomenal. And the CEO of Moderna wrote an incredible story or letter last year, I think it was, about the future of programmable medicines and how he sees it. And I think it's if you took time to go down deep into what's going on in medicine right now, you'd be amazed. Most people would be amazed at what's being researched.
Yeah, that is amazing. Well, gosh, Ben, our time has come to a close real quick. What is you hope that the reader will take away from reading the book? And you know, you talked about the new reality of the next 30 years. What is just maybe one thing that people can do to, you know, start, I guess, in preparation or you know, incorporating that new reality into the current reality?
Number one is act. Replace fear with pragmatic optimism, and teach that to your family. Gain perspective about the times we're in, and where we can go. And then last, I think, replace every other measure of success with you against your own potential and developing your own personal innate wisdom. That's it.
Wow. That is great. Well, Ben, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. And like I said, your book is very thought-provoking, and you've given you more to think about after our discussion. So I really want to thank you for your time today.
Great. Well, thank you, Robert, for the opportunity. And I wish every one of your readers well and hope that they have a remarkable potentialist life.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my special guest is Ben Lytle. We've been talking about his book, soon to be released on September 27th. Again, you can purchase your advanced copy now. The book is called The Potentialist, Your Future in the New Reality of the Next 30 Years. And again, you can find out more about Ben, his book, his blog, all by visiting his website, which is potentialistfuture.com. And so, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again,
thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, Blog Talk Radio, Amazon Music, and Audible. To follow our show on any of those platforms, visit ByteRadio.me and select the one you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ByteRadioMe. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touched.